Actually, there's one more point I wanted to mention about relying on a teacher before we move on to the next topic. And that is regarding our connection or distance from the teacher. And often the analogy given here is that the analogy of a fire is that if we sit too close to a fire, we get burnt. But if we're too far from the fire, we don't receive any warmth. So likewise, our connection to our personal teacher. If we're too far from the teacher, of course, we don't receive any warmth. So if we never can have a connection with the teacher and ask for advice, then we can't receive any inspiration or benefit. Which means I think it would be helpful to be able to personally meet and attend teachings with your personal teacher at least a few times a year. Because historically, of course, how it would work would be the teacher would give some instruction, you'd go away for some time, try and implement it, then come back and ask for advice. So you don't need to be living next door to the teacher. In fact, often that is like sitting too close to the fire, you get burnt. In two ways, actually. One is that if we're too close to the teacher, there's very much the danger that we use the teacher to absolve personal responsibility. Whenever we have to make a decision, oh, the teacher knows best. Let's ask the teacher. So we don't sort of take any decisions. In fact, I know someone who's been long time in the Dharma, and he still goes to the teacher to ask, if he's going somewhere, which airline or flight he should book. Serious. And we also, when I studied in Italy, we had at least one student who was a little bit like that. So our teacher would often in lunch break would walk around in the garden for a bit of exercise, and sometimes this student would see him and would sort of zoom over there. And often the teacher would simply ignore him or tell him to go away. Because often it was about very minor things. So we should not use the teacher to absolve personal responsibility. If it's some minor thing, then work it out ourselves. If it's a major thing, then of course we may need to go to the teacher for advice. And the other thing with the danger of being too close to the teacher is that if we are constantly seeing the teacher in contact, often we end up projecting a lot of faults onto the teacher because of our mental afflictions. And so we end up seeing a lot of faults which are not there. So therefore, I think it's good to have that healthy distance. Not too far, not too close. Okay, so that was the last point. So let's now go on to the next topic. So we're at the bottom of page 4, and it talks about a brief indication of how to sustain the meditation. The reason this comes here, of course, is that for each of the topics in the Lam Rim, we are to reflect and internalize that topic. So that we've just looked at the first topic of relying on a teacher, so now this comes. But this, of course, applies to every topic in the Lam Rim. And as we saw before the break, how to sustain the meditation, we need two things. We need actual meditation, where we internalize the topic, where we bring it into experience, and then also what to do between meditation sessions or in effectively the rest of our day. So if we want any practice to progress and be effective, we need both components of practice. We need a formal meditation to internalize and then have something to do for the rest of the day where we integrate into the daily life. So let's briefly look at those two points. So if we look at the bottom of page 4 then, what to do in the actual meditation session, there's three parts, of course. What to do at the beginning, the preparation, the actual meditation, and then what to do at the end. So in the preparation here, we see, it says, the six aspects of preparation. So this is a very standard presentation about how to set up a meditation session. I'll just briefly go through this. The first says, clean well the place and arrange representations of Buddha's body, speech, mind. So the point here is, it's very helpful to have a nice place to meditate. So if you've got a spare room at home, have that. Otherwise, at least some corner of the room dedicated to meditation, make it nice and comfortable, nice and clean. Because if it's sort of cluttered, that sort of agitates the mind. So make it a place that is comfortable and inviting. And also inspirational. So one of the things we can do there is have representations of the Buddha's body, speech, mind. Yes, we have over here. On this altar here, we see the statue of the Buddha in the middle. So that's symbolizing the body. Over this side, maybe you can't see very well, there's some texts, some scriptures. So that's the speech. And then over the other side, there's a stupa, which is the actual copy of the stupa from Bodh Gaya, where he achieved enlightenment. So that's symbolizing the Buddha's mind. So that's the sort of Tibetan tradition of having that on the altar. And then it goes on to say, obtain offerings and arrange them beautifully. So often also the tradition is at the beginning of a session to make some offerings. This comes from an ancient Indian tradition where if some important guest came to your house, you would make a lot of offerings to them. And traditionally, you would, in ancient Indian culture, you would first offer some water for them to wash their hands and feet, some water for them to drink. Then you would often arrange some flowers, make the room smell nice with some nice incense, some nice lights, maybe some candles. And then also offer them some perfume for nice smell, offer them, of course, some food and also some music. So these were the eight traditional things that you would offer an important guest in ancient India. And so this tradition then continued on within Buddhism in ancient India and into Tibet. So now in Tibetan Buddhism, you often see this sort of traditional symbolism of doing this offering. And it's usually in terms of a water bowl offering. So here we see eight offerings. So these are in these glasses and also on the side. So traditionally you would see these eight offerings in the form of water bowl offerings. But the idea of doing these offerings is to develop some generosity, to sort of open the heart a little bit. So this is a good way, a nice way to really start the meditation. Of course, if you want, you can do it in the sort of the formal Tibetan way, or you can do it in your own way. The point being here is to really make that sort of offering there to really open, to be more, to overcome stinginess, to be generous, to really open the heart.
Some say it's seven items, why is it eight?
Well, often the eighth one is the music. So often you see seven water bowls and like a conch shell or something, which is symbolizing the music. So sometimes you'll get the seven with that on the side. Sometimes you'll have eight. But it's the eight offerings generally. But again, this is the tradition. So it's much better to do it in a heartfelt way than sort of be pedantic about having exactly the right water measurements. Because often you see that. And of course, the purpose for that is to be mindful so that we're doing it with mindfulness. Yeah, but sometimes people get really uptight about that and go, oh, that's not the right amount of water. And of course, then we've lost the point. We're getting agitated where we're supposed to be opening the heart and being generous and being mindful. So that's the idea. So that's the main purpose. Yeah. And then it's the third point here. It says, sit up straight upon a comfortable seat in a suitable posture. So I think you went through the posture yesterday afternoon. So again, it's important to have a nice comfortable posture in the meditation. Again, the two most important points is the back straight and the body relaxed. And of course, you know, it talks about the full lotus posture and so forth. That's so that it's very stable. The idea being that we need to get the body in a good posture so that we can sort of forget about it, so that it doesn't create any problems. And that is a very stable posture. But of course, many of us are not used to that. Some of us have back problems, knee problems. So you need to adjust your posture according to so that you're comfortable. There's no point in forcing yourself into some posture, full lotus, and then having excruciating knee pain the whole meditation. That's not going to work. So again, relax body, back straight. Sit in a chair if you find that sitting like this is always painful. Again, relax body, back straight. And then it goes on to say, and then absorb yourself in the practices of going for refuge and developing the spirit of enlightenment. Here, the spirit of enlightenment is the way this bodhicitta aspiration is translated in this text. So going for refuge and generating bodhicitta, we're going to talk a lot about that later in the Lamrim, but essentially here it's to start the meditation by developing a positive motivation. Then it talks, number four, about visualizing the field for accumulating the collection of merit and wisdom. So here, this is what's called the merit field, and then we can make this elaborate visualization. In fact, we have a very elaborate merit field here, very elaborate, which I think has looks like Lama Tsong Kapa in the middle, and then all the lineage lamas behind, and then the various lamas from the various practices, and then at the bottom here, a lot of different tantric deities and so forth. So if you want to be very elaborate, then we can do something like that. Or more simple, of course, we can visualize our teacher or Shakyamuni Buddha. Or, you know, we talked about briefly the two aspects of practice of wisdom and compassion. And so often the wisdom side is symbolized by Manjushri and compassion by Avalokiteshvara Chenrezig or even Maitreya. And so then you can symbolize this. But I think the point is, as a beginner, is to do that very simply. And we can simply imagine our teacher if we have, or His Holiness Dalai Lama, or the Buddha. And then it says to purify your mind with the seven branches of worship. This is called the seven-limb prayer, which I'm not going to go through, but the seven things that we can do, as the name says, to purify our mind. And these seven points are really to do one of two things, either to purify our mind of negativities or increase the positive state of mind. And that's something we're going to see a little bit later here in this text. So again, this is simply to prepare the mind well for the meditation. That on top of the positive motivation is to then purify any negativities in the mind and then boost the positive state of the mind as well. So that's what this seven-limb prayer is about. And then the last point, point six, is make supplications many times with strong aspiration. So what this is about is make supplication is often what's called request blessings. And we're doing this with respect to the merit field that we've visualized in front of us, either our teacher or His Holiness or the Buddha, or very extensive like this. And requesting blessings is really about asking for inspiration to help us in our practice. You know, often people have this idea, in the Tibetan tradition, there's this very strong thing about requesting blessings, you know. And so then, you know, people have this idea, especially when I'm in Dharamsala there, that they go down the temple and then, you know, get blessings from His Holiness Dalai Lama, that somehow they'll go down there and His Holiness is going to zap us and we're going to see the light or something, you know. So people have this idea that, you know, we're going to get zapped or something and we're going to realize reality or something, I don't know. But actually it was very interesting. A few years ago, I was part of a sort of a small audience with His Holiness Dalai Lama in the temple, and he was giving a little talk, and then at one point he said, you know, I can't give you a blessing. Whether or not you get a blessing from me is up to you. So I think that's what blessing means. I mean, the word blessing in Tibetan is chinlap. And that literally means to transform your mind into a magnificent state. So what it means to do this supplication here or request the blessing is to open ourselves to receive inspiration from others. So then at the beginning of the meditation, then if we have visualized our teacher in front of us, we can simply say, please bless me or please inspire me to be able to do this practice and progress on the path. And in that way, and then often with that, you have this visualization where you absorb your teacher or whatever into yourself. And the purpose for this is to really uplift the mind, to chinlap, to put it in a magnificent state, to really be inspired and uplifted to do the practice. That's the purpose here. Rather than think, just sit there and think someone's going to zap us and we don't have to do anything ourselves. So this is what we're talking about here, is putting that mind in this very inspirational, uplifted state, asking for inspiration to be able to do the practice. So this is how we can prepare our mind well at the beginning of the meditation. Any question about preparation? Of course, here, what you'll find is often in certain meditation texts in the Tibetan tradition, this is very formally laid out in terms of refuge bodhicitta prayer and even mandala offering, seven limb prayer, four immeasurables and all this. So often there's this very long list. And then people sort of look at that and go, okay, I have to do this list. And they go, I go for refuge and I'm like, tick, okay, let's meditate. And then, of course, no point. So the point with all of these things is to prepare ourselves well for the meditation, to not only have a good posture, but to set a good motivation, to inspire ourselves, to really prepare the body and mind well for meditation. And if we want to use this sort of formal way of setting it out, good. But the point is not to just rattle off these prayers as fast as we can so that we can meditate, because then what happens is it becomes a sort of chore, you know, oh, I have to do these prayers again before I can meditate. And then we've sort of lost the point, you know. So again, the point is to, in whatever way we do, whether we do it in a sort of this formal way or in our own way, is really just prepare our mind well for meditation, setting a good motivation, receiving inspiration, opening the heart by some sort of generosity at the beginning. So this is the important point. Okay. The actual session, the things mentioned here, I'm going to go into in some detail later when we talk about this shamatha practice. But just briefly, a couple of points. So at the top of page 5, under actual session, the second line, it says, therefore meditate in many short sessions. Because in the previous one it says here, if you meditate for a long time, you will be readily susceptible to laxity and excitation, or in other words, dullness and distraction. If this becomes your habit, it will be then difficult to correct your awareness. So the key phrase here is quality over quantity. Much better to meditate in a focused way for a short time than for a long time, simply getting caught up in dullness and distraction. And I'll talk more about how long that should be in that section on the shamatha, but the key phrase again, quality over quantity. Keep the session short, and so that you can sustain that with some focus and not just fall into dullness and distraction. The other thing is how to sustain the meditation in general. Here it talks about sustaining your meditation in the last part of that paragraph with mindfulness and vigilance. So these are the two main tools we use in our practice. Mindfulness, again, is the ability to hold the object without becoming distracted. And here, vigilance, or sometimes translated as introspection, is quality control. It's checking how we are going. Are we still focusing on our object of meditation, or are we becoming dull and distracted? So this vigilance or introspection is this quality control and monitoring whether we're falling into dullness or distraction. So these are the two main tools that we use in our meditation practice. And I'll speak much more about that later in the Shamatha section of the Lam Rim. And then at the end, conclusion, how to end the meditation, then it talks here about dedicating the virtue that you have accumulated. So not only is it good to set a good motivation at the beginning of the meditation, but at the end of the meditation, then really dedicate the positive merit that you've accumulated from that meditation towards the goal that you set in your motivation. And that can really direct that meditation toward that goal. So that's very briefly the actual meditation session. Again, I'll speak more about that later. Now what I'd like to do is have a look at what to do between meditation sessions. Because remember, if we want to be effective in our practice, we need to integrate our practice into daily life. We need to continue to cultivate our practice in daily life. And so here there are some general tips about what sorts of things we can do in our daily life to help support our practice so that it doesn't sort of get dissipated. So in the first paragraph here under what to do in between meditation sessions, it says the principal thing to do in this context is as follows. In between sessions, look at teachings that reveal the meaning of your object of meditation. So again, here it's talking about then study and contemplation is to continue to read about, contemplate the thing you're meditating on to support your meditation practice. So this is very important. And then the next part, the next two sentences says, accumulate by many means the collections which are favourable conditions for producing good qualities. Also clear away by many means the obscurations which are unfavourable conditions. So here, as a general background to every practice, there are two things that support each practice. And that is what's called accumulation and purification. Accumulation is really talking, in fact, in terms of accumulation, we can talk about the two accumulations, or sometimes called the two collections, which is merit and wisdom. Merit here is basically the result of virtuous actions. So when we talk about accumulating merit, we're talking about engaging in virtuous positive behaviour. So here then, by engaging in the two accumulations, in particular here, the accumulation of merit, we're talking about, in general, engaging in virtuous positive behaviour in our daily life to really increase this merit, this positive state of mind. You know, often in the Tibetan tradition, when someone's having a lot of difficulty in doing a practice and not really getting anywhere, you know, often you hear the Tibetan saying, well, they don't have enough merit. They got no merit. They can't do it because they got no merit. And so what they're really talking about is this, is that to really have that sort of positive energy, that positive potential to support us in the practice, we need to engage in virtuous behaviour. So this is what it means here. And then the opposite of that is then this purification, that also, to support our practice in general, we need to purify our mind of negative states of mind, negative habits, to reduce any negative energy that we have. And this, how to do that effectively, the purification aspect, is one of the main topics I think we're going to be covering tomorrow morning. So we'll leave it till then, how to do this purification. But in general, for any practice, again, is accumulate the merit, meaning engage in virtuous actions to increase the virtuous energy, the purifying the negative habits or behaviour to reduce the negative. So in general, this is the support, and this is what's being talked about here. And then it goes on to say, furthermore, learn the four following preconditions, which are causes for readily produce paths of serenity and insight. So here, this word serenity is how they have translated shamatha in this text. And insight is a translation of vipassana. So here we're talking about shamatha vipassana practice. So four preconditions are listed below. So we have four outlines following here, which are going, four things that we can do in our daily life to really help be preconditions or the support for developing shamatha vipassana practice. The first is restraining the sensory faculties. So I think this is fairly obvious, is to not allow ourselves to get caught up in a lot of sensory distractions, so a lot of attachment to sense pleasures and so forth. So if we do that, of course, our mind often becomes very agitated and distracted. So we can, you know, in some traditions, they really, particularly a lot of the Theravada traditions, they put a lot of emphasis on this. And so therefore, particularly you'll find in Theravadan monasteries and nunneries, monks and nuns, when they're walking around, really are looking down all the time. They're not looking up, so that then they get caught up in a lot of sensory distractions, you know. So, of course, you know, we don't need to do that, but what we're saying is that it's best not to allow ourselves to get caught up in a lot of sensory stimulation, because this is not really going to help us. The second point here is acting with vigilance. And the first sentence there says, work on these practices of restraining the sensory faculties and acting with vigilance. For it is said that if you do, you will have unusual success in all your virtuous practices in particular, and in particular, your ethical discipline will be completely pure, and you will easily attain the non-discursive states of concentration that comprise meditative serenity and insight. So that sounds good. So, I mean, it's really emphasizing here that if we really do restrain our sensory stimulation and we act with vigilance, and of course, acting with vigilance here, we can look at the summary of that. At the bottom of that paragraph, just before appropriate diet, the last sentence there says, in short, be mindful of whatever behaviors may take place in the night or day. Then understand which are to be done and which are not to be done. Whenever engaging or turning away, be vigilant. So here again, it's talking about first vigilance in terms of understanding what are behaviors appropriate to engage in and what sorts of things are appropriate to turn away from, any negative behavior. And then be vigilant is to be have this awareness, this mindfulness of either engaging in the virtuous behavior or mindfully turning away from any negative behavior. So this is what vigilance means here, is to have that awareness of that. Because if we just go through day, because often we are simply stimulus reaction machines. Some stimulus comes and we just react out of habit. And often our habits of reacting are not very good. So that's not what we want to do. Here, being vigilant means if some stimulus comes, to be aware of what that is. And if it's something that's going to stimulate negative behavior, then to stop that, not engage, react. And if it's some stimulus, then we're going to engage in some positive behavior, to do that in a mindful way and not react. So instead of stimulus reaction machines, we need to, with mindfulness and vigilance, respond appropriately in our daily life behavior. But again, we're going to talk more about that later. Then the third point here is appropriate diet. It says an appropriate diet has four attributes: not eating too little, not eating too much, eating digestible and wholesome food, and eating appropriate food, which does not cause afflictions. So I think that's all fairly self-explanatory, that, of course, a good diet is going to be very helpful. Unfortunately, in our modern day society, of course, our diets tend not to be very good. Too much sort of processed food, particularly way too much sugar. And I think a lot of these factors are one of the major contributors to the ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Of course, there are genetic factors, other factors, but I think one of the main factors that seems to be prevalent in our modern society is simply diet. I mean, you know, I guess it's the same here, but I know when I go home to Australia and I go to the supermarket, one whole row, long row shelf of stuff is Coca-Cola. Wow. I mean, the whole row of different sizes and shapes, and of course Sprite and other things, but really a whole long row is just Coca-Cola. And then I see people with their trolleys having crates of this stuff, they're checking out, and I'm thinking, this is a disaster. I mean, so no wonder, you know, young children who are guzzling all this Coke, no wonder they have attention deficit hyperactivity at school. I mean, it's a nightmare. So I think it's important that we have a healthy diet, so we have a healthy body to support our practice, of course. And then the last point talks about sleep. And it talks about, you know, sleeping at the right time and so forth. But just one point I want to mention on that, and that is that this is very important. If we want to meditate, we need to get enough sleep. Unfortunately, in our modern society, we tend to have very hectic, busy lives, and never enough time for anything. And where we cut the corners, of course, is we cut our sleep. And I think if we do that, we're not going to be able to meditate, we're not going to be able to practice. In fact, I read something recently, and I think it's the same in every country, but it was about the US, that a study said that 75% of US people suffer sleep deprivation. So, I mean, that's enormous. That's enormous. And I think it's probably the same in most modern societies, unfortunately. So we need to make sure we get enough sleep. Otherwise, of course, we're not going to be able to meditate, and we're just going to fall into dullness and distraction.
Can you say something about what it says about the four kinds of thoughts with which to fall asleep?
Yeah. So at a higher level, we can actually practice while we're asleep. There's, you know, in the higher levels of Tibetan Buddhism, particularly in this Tantra Vajrayana, there's practices called dream yoga and sleep yoga. And part of that is that as a practice to gain access to this very subtle level of mind to prepare for the time of death and use dreaming and sleep as part of practice. You know, because we know we can talk about lucid sleep, lucid dreaming. So actually we can develop lucid dreaming and use lucid dreaming and use that as a practice and practice in the lucid dream. But also we can develop what's called lucid sleep as well. That's possible. In fact, there's great Indian master Shanti Deva from the 8th century who's very famous. And when he was first in the monastery, the other monks called him the monk that does three things or something. And basically they said all he does is eat, sleep and go to the toilet. Because that's all they saw. What he was doing was he was practicing this, dream yoga, sleep yoga. And then, of course, they wanted to embarrass him. So they asked him to teach. And then they set up this high throne that with no steps to get up to embarrass him. And then he came, and then somehow all of a sudden he was sitting on the throne and they were going, what happened? And then he proceeded to teach, and of course he was teaching the Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, which is one of the classic texts of the Bodhisattva path. And so this was Shanti Deva. So therefore these four points here are to help us to move in that direction and to then in terms of mindfulness and vigilance and so forth. So we can then use that period as a practice as well.
I know what lucid dreaming is. What is lucid sleeping?
Well, it's the same idea. It's more difficult, of course, because in deep sleep, the mind is more subtle. Mm-hmm. But see, as we're going to look at later, we briefly looked yesterday at this idea of the coarse, subtle, very subtle mind. And during the death process, the mind sort of collapses down to the very subtle level. But in a normal person in a death process, it's sort of unconscious process. Just like for a normal person, when we're falling asleep, well before we're asleep, we lose mindfulness. It becomes unconscious. But so the process is a little bit similar. So if we can, in daily life, develop the capacity to maintain mindfulness as we're falling asleep, keep that mindfulness in deep sleep and dreaming, which is lucid sleep, lucid dreaming. If we can do that, that's a good preparation for being able to maintain mindfulness through the death process. So then there's a lot of emphasis in the higher levels of Tibetan Buddhist practice in this dream yoga and sleep yoga. So yeah, lucid sleep is to know that you're in deep sleep, to be aware of that. A little bit more difficult than lucid dreaming. Okay. Oh, sorry.
Back up to restraining the sensory faculties.
Sure.
So, I assume if we're not a Theravada monk, that doesn't mean denying sensory pleasures, but again, it's about not attaching to the experience.
Yeah. So, restraining sensory faculties, of course, is, I mean, denying is the other extreme. The two extremes are getting caught up, and the other one is suppressing. So here, what we're talking about is not allowing ourselves to get caught up in the sensory experiences. So, therefore, as a beginner, probably not a good idea to expose ourselves to over too much stimulus. I mean, we don't have to walk around like this all day, but, you know, equally well, we don't need to, you know, go on to a big screen and go into these heavy stimulus computer game stuff, you know. So that's what restraining sense faculties is really talking about here, is not allow ourselves to get caught up in over sensory stimulus. But of course we're not trying to deny as well, because we have to function in daily life, of course. And also, of course, another slight difference is that here in the Lam Rim, we're really emphasizing the Mahayana ideal, which is emphasizing a lot of benefiting others as well. So we need to keep that close connection with other people, but simply just to not unnecessarily overly stimulate the senses in distractions, that's all.
I've always been afraid to ask my teacher this, but I feel safe here to talk about it. So I think growing up Judeo-Christian, there's always this idea that like music and dance and art, that these are all like sensory experiences that somehow we should be avoiding, right? And I actually find them very healing and helpful.
Sure.
And good, and
sure,
oftentimes,
sure,
benefiting others. And
sure.
So I don't know if you can just talk a little bit more about,
sure,
that.
Sure. Yeah. So again, I think, as you rightly said, it depends really on why we're engaging in these activities. And of course we can engage in a lot of the sensory stuff, even in music, just to really get completely caught up and agitated and so forth. But of course, if we engage in these activities with mindfulness, then they can be, I mean, they can even be a sort of a shamatha practice of really focusing the mind. And certainly, of course, when we talk about higher-level tantric practices, often that involves chanting mantras, which, of course, is sound, you know, this rhythmic chanting mantra. So in that sense, then, of course, these modalities can also be very helpful. Mm-hmm. So again, it really depends on how we're using them and what for what purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are we using them as a way of just stimulating the senses?
Yeah.
Or are we...
Yeah,
or to check out, to zone out, mm-hmm, or are we using rhythmic music to get us focused, or even in some sort of healing practice? Then I think that's fine.
Okay.
I'm kind of having a problem last night also, sort of reconciling the notion of non-attachment and passion.
Mm.
mean, are Buddhists not passionate people? When you have passion for your work, or passion for art, or passion for justice, and have that not be an attachment.
Yeah. Actually, this is a topic I was going to look at, I think, tomorrow or the next day in detail, but I'll give a brief answer now. And it really comes down to this word passion. You know, what do we mean by the word passion? And I think in passion, usually there are two things mixed together. One is to be passionate about something is to aspire for something. And hopefully we're talking about being passionate towards something worthwhile. You know, we can be passionate towards taking a lot of drugs, but but if we're talking about being passionate towards something worthwhile, then there's a mixture. There's this really passion or aspiration to achieve that, but often with that passion comes a lot of craving and attachment for that thing. And usually there's that dynamic where we have both of those mixed in, and generally it sort of feels like just the one thing, there's just passion. But then we have a dilemma because it seems like passion can give us good things, but it seems like passion can also create a lot of suffering. So what should we do, you know? But actually, from a Buddhist perspective, there's two things here. There's the passion in terms of aspiring. That's for good. That we need to increase. The part of the passion, which is the craving and attachment for that, that we need to get rid of. That's attachment. So what you will find, and that's what I'm going to talk about more tomorrow, that we need this motivation, you know. The highest passion is bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment so we can help others. So this sort of passion we need to increase, but the attachment that normally is mixed in, we need to identify that and slowly, you know, get that out of the way. Because in fact, it's things like attachment that block us from realizing the goals of our passion. If we really want to be creative, get rid of attachment. Then you'll be much more creative, much more passionate in a good way. But anyway, I'm going to talk more about that tomorrow. I think tomorrow or the next day, but it's coming very soon. Yeah, so it's not like as a good Buddhist we just sit there and sort of have no drive. We need to increase our drive, but we need to have healthy drive and get rid of the unhealthy drive. That's what we need to do. So we need to be very passionate without the attachment.
So pretty much, once you generate in bodhicitta at a level, like everything falls in line where that's why you're doing kind of everything?
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, of course, now we need to artificially generate this sort of motivation, this really good motivation. But as we deepen that, it really becomes spontaneous.
Right.
And so spontaneously we're doing everything for that highest passion.
That's pretty passionate. Once you get to that point, you
absolutely.
There's no dirt in it.
And often the way to notice if there's attachment in the passion, what's your state of your mind? Is your mind agitated or is it very calm? If it's agitated, definitely attachment's present. If it's very calm and yet passionate, good sign.
One question about the idea of rising, going to sleep with the idea of rising. Is that just literally the idea of rising, or is that setting your motivation, or what is that?
That's a lot to do with the fact of then in the morning that we sort of don't wake up like that we can arise with a fresh mind. Because often it's our intention that is key. Like, let's say we're one particular morning we have to go off early. Maybe we have to go to an early flight. We have to get up at like 3:30 or 4 o'clock, and we set the alarm for 4 o'clock. And it's very important for us. How often do we wake up 5 minutes to four, just before the alarm? Why? Because we have the intention to wake up at four. So same if we have this intention to wake up like this, then we can. Okay. So let's now go and look at the next topic. So we're on the top of page 6. So now The first topic is, it says at the top there, the stages of how the students train their minds after having relied on the teacher. And the first topic here is in terms of an exhortation to take full advantage of a life of leisure and opportunity. So this is the topic on reflecting on our precious human life. Because often we take things for granted and we don't appreciate something until we've lost it or are about to lose it. So often then what happens is that later in our life, as we're about to lose this precious human life, and we look back on our life, we're full of regrets at having wasted our life. And so here, then, this reflection is to appreciate the precious opportunity we have now while we have it, so then we can do something with our life. And so this is the reflection here. And it talks about leisure and opportunity. Leisure here means that we have a life of leisure, means a life free of adverse conditions. Opportunity means we have a life of conducive conditions. And generally we talk about the 8 leisures and the 10 opportunities, that there are 8 things that we are free from, 8 adverse conditions, and 10 positive conditions that we have in this precious human life. So let's briefly have a look at those. If we look under the heading there of leisure, it says leisure means freedom from a rebirth in any of the 8 conditions that lack leisure. So here it talks about that we are not in a state of this disadvantaged state, these 8 states, we are free from this. 4 of these 8 are talking about the fact that we're not in a type of existence other than being human that has disadvantages. And then 4 of them talk about disadvantaged states within a human that we're free of. So let's have a look at those. And we're going to look at those based on this chart here, this wheel of life. So if you'd like to grab that in your handouts. Because the first 4, it says to be reborn with wrong views, without the conqueror's word. Well, actually, they're listed here in a different order. So the first 4 are to do with not being born in 4 states which have a disadvantage. And they are here, number 3, an animal, 4, hungry ghost, number 5, hell being, and number 8, deity of long life. So very briefly, and we're going to look at this wheel of life diagram a number of times in the coming days, is that this describes the process of samsara, how we are stuck in this cycle of existence called samsara. For now, we're only going to be looking at the sections in the middle, where the wheel is divided up into these 5 sections in the middle here. These are describing the different types of existences that are possible within this cycle of existence called samsara. And very briefly, if we look from sort of 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock up the top here.
In the middle, you mean the large section?
The large section in the middle that's divided into 5 segments. Up the top between 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock, we see here some people walking around, some houses and so forth. So this is describing the human realm. That's the realm that we exist in now. And then over sort of from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock over the other side here, we see some animals, some birds, and down the bottom I think there's supposed to be some fish down there as well. So that's the animal realm, animal type of existence. And then if we go up sort of from 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock, there's sort of two groups of beings there, one above the other. This is actually symbolizing two different realms that are very similar. The upper part is symbolizing what's called the Deva realm, and the lower half is what's considered the Asura realm. Here, this Deva realm is being translated in this text as deity. So when it talks about long life deity, it's talking about this realm. And sometimes this Deva realm is also translated into English as something like God realm. But of course, we're not talking about the Christian idea of a creator God. We're simply talking about a type of existence that has immense pleasure, very little suffering. So both the Asura and Deva realms, the beings there don't have this coarse body like us, very subtle body of light, lot of pleasure, very little suffering. And then if we go over between 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock, we see some beings there not looking like they're having a very good time, some with flames coming out of their mouth, big belly. This is called what's called the Preta realm. And in this type of existence, then the beings even struggle to have the basic necessities of life. And so, therefore, this Preta realm is sometimes translated as hungry ghost or hungry spirit realm. And then down the bottom, between 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock, we have some beings there with lots of flames and torture and so forth. This is symbolizing what's called the Narak realm. And in the Narak realm, there is a lot of suffering, particularly physical suffering. Therefore, sometimes this word Narak is translated as hell realm or hell being. So that's what's being translated here as the hell being. So in terms of the spiritual path, in terms of spiritual path, then what is unfavorable is to be born in a realm where there's a lot of suffering. Because if we have too much suffering, we don't have any opportunity to do anything. And so generally within the Preta, Narak and animal realm, there's too much suffering to be able to do anything. And often also not enough cognitive ability to do anything anyway. So there are three of the unfavorable states that we are free from. But also it talks about here this long life, the deity of long life. And that's talking about this Deva realm here. And the Deva realm, the problem with the Deva realm is there's too much pleasure. And there's not enough, there's no motivation to do anything. So beings in that realm have no motivation to do anything because life's good, no suffering hardly, lots of pleasure. So there's no motivation to engage in spiritual path. So in terms of spiritual practice, that's also not a very favorable place to be. So those four are not states that are really conducive to spiritual practice. So that's why they are the four types of non-human leisure that we're free of. Question?
In what realm are the beings who are depicted as actually conducting the tortures?
The torturers, there are different assertions about that depending on the philosophical view. But generally in the philosophical view that there is no independent objective reality, the view is that these torturers are our own mind. Yeah, I mean it's our mental afflictions basically and so forth, yeah. So these are the four non-human states that we're free of. Each of those four are not conducive basis for spiritual practice. Three of them because too much suffering, the other one too much pleasure. Then also there are four states within the human type of existence that we're free of, which are mentioned here. So wrong views here is talking about, having a view of not opposite to what's required for spiritual practice. So a wrong view that there are no consequences to my actions and being ethical doesn't matter and all this sort of thing. So we are free from that. The next point is without a conqueror's word, which is talking about, of course, the teachings of the Buddha. So this is talking about that we are not living in a time where there are no teachings available, that the Buddha has come and has taught and the teachings are available. So we're free of being in a condition where there are no spiritual teachings existing. And then we go to number six, an uncultured person in a border region. often in the text is translated something like being a barbarian or something. But what this means is that it's talking about not living in a place, in the wrong place, basically. Not living in a place where there's no teachings. Because historically, of course, the teachings weren't available in everywhere on the planet. I mean, now, of course, it's a bit different, but that's what it's talking about here, is that we're free of living in a place where the teachings are not existing. So, wrong place. So that probably doesn't apply any much anymore anywhere really in the world. But historically, of course, it did. And then the other one, a stupid moot person. This is talking about where sense faculties are not working. So if we have no sense faculties, here it's talking about not being able to hear and speak. But, of course, if we can't, historically, if we couldn't hear or speak, then, of course, we couldn't receive any instructions from anybody. So here it's talking about that we're free of the state of not having sense faculties, which does not allow us to be able to receive any teachings. So these are the four states within the human realm that we're free of. So these are the eight states of leisure that we are free from. And then we have what's called the 10 opportunities, which are 10 conducive states that we do have. Some of these are a little bit just the opposite of the eight, but let's have a look at them. The first five are to do with ourself. So the first one here is being a human. So we have that conducive condition. The second one is being born in a central region. So here, central region is simply meaning being in a place where the teachings exist. And again, I think in the world today, that's pretty well nearly the whole planet is a central region. Third, having complete sensory faculties, meaning we have senses so that we can receive the teachings. And then the fourth is having reversible karma. This is talking about, it's considered that sometimes if we have done some very heavy negative things in our life, that this can really become a big obstacle to us. And so the fact that we haven't done that is a conducive condition. And the fifth one is having faith in the source, meaning the opposite of wrong view is that we have faith in ethics, law of cause and effect, and we have faith in trying to follow a more meaningful life style. So these are the five aspects, conducive aspects for ourselves, and then there's five aspects that pertain to others, meaning to external factors. So the first here is that a Buddha has visited, meaning that the Buddhist teachings have come into existence on this planet. The second one is that the sublime teaching is being taught. The first one is that actually enlightened being has actually been present on the planet. And the second one is that he taught. The third one is that teaching that he gave is remaining. The fourth one is that there are still those who follow it. And the fifth one is that there is caring for others, meaning that there is support from others available to us in the spiritual path. So these are the five conditions, external factors that we have available to us that provide a conducive condition to have a spiritual life. And so this is what it means to have a precious human life. It's talking about freedom from unfavorable conditions and having favorable conditions. Question.
Can you speak about reversible karma again?
Reversible, and we're going to talk about this tomorrow morning when we're going to talk about the topic of karma. Reversible karma means that we can purify any negative actions that we do. And so even though we engage in some harmful behavior, we can purify that. But there are certain very strong negative behaviors which are very difficult to purify. And so most of our negative actions is called reversible. We can purify. But some very heavy things like killing our mother and father and so forth, it said, and there are only a very few, are very difficult then to purify. And if we engage in those, then it really becomes a problem, an obstacle for us to move forward in the spiritual path. So reversible karma means we haven't gone into this very heavy negative behavior.
Are those actually listed?
Yeah, they're listed. They are usually listed as five. Five of them, something like killing your mother and your father and
a
heart and
separating
the spiritual community, and then I think injuring a Buddha or something like this. These sort of five are listed because they are considered to be very heavy actions which are hard, very difficult to purify.
Did you say the first one under opportunity was that a Buddha is actually present?
That a Buddha has come to this planet, has appeared in this world, not present now. Okay. So this is what it means to have a precious human life. So we're not just talking about any human life. We're talking about a human life that has these 8 leisures and 10 opportunities, because that gives us very good conditions to follow a spiritual path. And then we are to also not only understand this, but then there are 2 more points here. It talks about contemplating the great importance of leisure and opportunity. And in the middle there, on the second line in the middle, it says, a human life is the supreme basis for initially achieving the path. So again, when we look at these five or six types of existences, you know, we can ask the question, what is the best type of existence? So if we mean by best, most pleasure, least suffering, then of course the Deva realm wins hands down. But if we mean by best, the best basis to be able to escape this wheel of samsara altogether, then the human existence is said to be best. Because as we saw, the animal, preta and narak realms, too much suffering and not enough cognitive ability to do anything anyway. And both the asura and deva realm, too much pleasure, not enough suffering, no motivation to do anything. So therefore, the human realm has enough good conditions, but enough suffering and enough cognitive ability to do something about it. So this is the right mix, the best mix to have as a basis for the spiritual path. So that is what it means by the great importance of leisure and opportunity, to understand that we have the best conditions here in the precious human life to be able to follow the spiritual path. And then also we are to reflect on the next point, the difficulty of attaining leisure and opportunity. That actually it's often said that this precious human life is very rare, very rare. Because even within, if we just look at the human humans on this planet now, we can see how many people on this planet don't have this opportunity that we have now. And then if we extend that to the other types of existences, we can really see that the type of life we have now is extremely rare and that it's easily lost. It's easy to lose this. That within this human life, certain conditions could come and we no longer have the opportunity to follow a spiritual path. We may have some physical, financial, mental, environmental problems that stop us from being able to follow the spiritual path. But of course, also from the Buddhist perspective, the bigger picture, that, you know, we don't know where we're going to end up in the next life. And if we've really engaged in not a very meaningful life and particularly engaged in quite a lot of harmful behaviour, then we're really setting up the conditions to end up in not a very pleasant place in the future. And then from there, it's going to be very difficult to come back into this type of life we have now. So this is to reflect on the difficulty of actually achieving this life and how easily it's lost and how difficult it is to get it back again. So if we reflect on this great importance and rarity and difficulty, then we'll really appreciate this precious opportunity we have now, and we're not going to want to waste our life. And so then if we really reflect on this, then we're going to want to make our life meaningful. We're not going to want to waste our life. And then how to make this precious human life meaningful, we looked at a little bit yesterday afternoon and early this morning in terms of the three levels of person. That at the minimum level that we can make our life meaningful is simply to strive for a good future in this life and in following lives. And then on top of that, at the next level, we can then on that basis of having this what's called high status, we can then strive to break free of samsara altogether. We can strive for personal liberation. So that's the person of medium capacity. We're striving for this goal of nirvana. But then, of course, on that basis, we can understand that we're not the only ones stuck in samsara. Everyone else is also stuck in samsara. So then we can have this aspiration to help to liberate everyone else from samsara. But, of course, to be able to do that, we need to fully develop ourselves as well, which means that we need to go on to achieve full enlightenment. So then we can aspire to full enlightenment so that we can help to liberate everyone else from samsara as well. So that's someone of great capacity. So these are the three levels at which we can make our human life meaningful. Simply to strive for a good future, the next level to break free of this cycle of samsara altogether, and the next level to achieve enlightenment so we can help to liberate everyone else from samsara. So that's what we're going to be looking at in the Lam Rim now, is how to make our life meaningful at those three levels, ever increasing level of motivation. Any questions about the precious human life?
Yes.
Yeah.
When I was reading this last night, I don't think I understand the breaking free from samsara within context of the preservation of consciousness. So are you escaping this wheel entirely?
So remember, samsara is not a place.
Right.
Samsara is a state of mind. So, and if we talk about the continuum of our mind, then our mind now has mental afflictions. So now we're experiencing samsara, meaning we're having mental afflictions and suffering. If we then, on the basis of this precious human life, we work to eliminate those mental afflictions and suffering, then at some point here we achieve nirvana. Which means here now our mind is free of the mental afflictions and therefore free of suffering. We're still experiencing the same world. The mind continues on. But here we're saying that if we want to be effective in helping others, we need to achieve enlightenment. So then we go on to, and how we go from nirvana to enlightenment I'll talk about later. Then we continue on, and at some point here, we achieve enlightenment. And the mind continues on, and then from there on, we can really be most effective in helping others. Life after life after life after life continues. Okay. One thing that it may be is that, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later, is often within the Theravada traditions, you know, they would accept that the Buddha achieved enlightenment, but often it's accepted that he was a rare person, that we can't do that, it's beyond us. We can achieve nirvana. So, therefore, often the final goal is the state of nirvana. And then, because of the philosophical basis of those traditions, then often they would say that when we have achieved this goal of nirvana, and then, let's say, then this the life that we achieved it in comes to an end, then they would say that the person, the body and the mind, finished. So then what is after this? There's no longer appearing in the world, according to their understanding. From the Mahayana perspective, this sort of sounds a little bit illogical. And so from the Mahayana perspective is that the person who has achieved nirvana and then this body finishes simply ends up in this sort of mental state of peace, which is a temporary state, and they pop out of that, and then eventually they understand they haven't achieved the final goal and they continue on appearing in the world to enlightenment and then continuing to appear, helping sentient beings forever. So this is what we're going to be looking at.
So in the Theravada, you said that once they've achieved nirvana, then they don't come back. They're not in the world.
They don't come back in the world, yes,
so
after
you said,
that.
That nirvana and enlightenment, those states of mind, not a place.
It's not a place, correct.
Then where do the Theravadas go?
Well, there's no one to go, because at that point, when the body finishes and the contaminated mind finishes, there's no person anymore. From a Mahayana perspective, that's sort of a bit illogical.
So they've reached nirvana, though, for what purpose?
To liberate themselves from the endless cycle of suffering.
Only to have it end.
Yeah, but then it's peace. But actually, sometimes the Dalai Lama said if he thought that was the ultimate goal of the spiritual path, maybe he wouldn't want to go on it.
So you're saying that the end of Theravada tradition they don't finish, they don't practice anymore.
Even within some of the Mahayana traditions, there's not much tantra, because most or many of the Buddhist countries established Buddhism before tantra really became fully developed in India. You may find small bits of tantra, maybe even in some of the Theravada traditions and in some of the Mahayana, but my understanding is that tantra or Vajrayana in its fully developed form only exists really in Tibetan Buddhism.
I was going to say, it seems like the Theravada are setting aside that conservation law you mentioned earlier. Maybe that's a law just on our side.
Yeah, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Okay. Maybe we leave it there. Okay, let's stop there. So I'll now give a couple of discussion group questions, and then at 2 o'clock, then just go to your discussion groups. Nice weather today, so you might like to maybe sit outside. So the tables here, the platform here outside the Gompa, and then over near the stupa there's some space as well, so find a spot. So the first question is relating to the first topic this morning, relying on a teacher. So the question is, do we really need a teacher? Do we really need a teacher? And the second part of the first question is, if so, how should we rely upon them? If so, how should we rely upon them? And the second question is to do with, we looked at the how to sustain the meditation. There was the two parts, what to do in the meditation and what to do in between the sessions, meaning in daily life. So the question is, how are each of the points in what to do in between meditation sessions important? So how is each of the things we need to do between meditation sessions, how is each one of those important? Meaning, how are each of these points important in our daily life? So how are each of the points in what to do between meditation sessions important? And then the third question goes back to yesterday afternoon's topic. We talked about the mind. So the question is, does the Buddhist concept of mind seem plausible? Means, does it make sense? Does the Buddhist concept of mind seem plausible? In terms of continuity, conservation, all of that. And the second part of the third question is, what sort of evidence would either support or negate this concept? Mm-hmm. What sort of evidence would support or negate this concept? So, meaning, can you think of any sort of scientific evidence that would either support the Buddhist theory of mind or seem to be opposite or oppose the Buddhist theory of mind. So again, if you have any questions coming out of discussion group, then bring them back at 3:30 and we'll try to resolve any questions before we move on in the Lam Rim text. So let's break for lunch now and we'll see you back at 3:30.